From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in jail, the Monroe County Correctional Facility. You might have heard the story recently on WXXI News, reported by my colleague Brett Dahlberg. He tells the story of Sam Lucius, a 26-year-old woman who said she was in a very dark place when she went to jail, where she spent more than 4 months. Now, she had overdosed on opioids, and she had tried to kill herself. It took 3 shots of Narcan and CPR to revive her. Shortly thereafter, she was caught stealing and was sent to jail, and it might have saved her life. She credits the support of jail counselors for turning her life in a dramatic new direction. She calls it a complete turnaround, and when she finally left jail, Sam felt like she had a toolbox of skills to take with her. It's important. As we've recently reported on Connections, the strong majority of American inmates will be arrested again for similar offenses within 3 to 5 years. Sam doesn't want to be in that position. And this hour we build on Brett's reporting to discuss the impact of rehabilitation, the work being done to help unsentenced women in particular, but also inmates in general. And my guests include my colleague, WXXI health reporter and producer Brett Dahlberg. Wonderful work on this, as always. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us in studio is Sam Lucius, a Rochester resident who benefited from the counseling programs. And thank you, Sam. How are you?
Hi, I'm great.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Tisha Smith, Director of Inmate Drug and Alcohol Treatment Programs in the Jail Bureau at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. Tisha, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Frankie Sampson, Drug and Alcohol Counselor in the Jail Bureau at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. Welcome to you as well, Frankie.
Thank you for having me.
This was a powerful story, and we're going to get into Sam's story in particular in just a moment. How did it hit your radar in the first place, Brett?
So I have been reporting for a while on efforts in Monroe County and the surrounding areas to combat the opioid epidemic, and as part of that, I was talking to folks in the correctional system, and I heard that there was a program that was specifically looking to address a need for counseling in unsentenced women. And that stuck out to me because it was a specific population that we were naming. And so I wanted to know more, and I talked to Dr. Smith and to Frankie, and they pointed me to Sam. And I, you know, Sam can talk more about this, but I'll just say I called Sam and I asked if she had a few minutes, and she said sure. And one of the first things that she said was, "Jail saved my life." And that hit me as something that, you know, I haven't been in the correctional system, and I should be clear, I'm reporting on this from the from an outside perspective, where I you know, don't know a whole lot about what it's like to be in the system. But my sense was that jail is often a hopeless place, and Sam expressed right away that it was not, and that hit me, and I wanted to keep reporting on it.
No question. A credit to two of our guests here who helped make it that way. But, you know, to the point that Brett is making, Tisha, I think, you know, we've spent hours and we will continue to spend hours on opioids in general. How much have you seen that sort of swell the challenges that you're facing at work?
It's swelled our challenges tremendously, such that we ended up applying for another grant and got a $250,000 grant to open up two specific units that will focus specifically on opioids, but it's a small part of a larger program that we have for all of our drug and alcohol program participants. And so it's another component, another thing that we can be proud of as a community, that we actually have these services for folks that are dealing with opioid addiction.
Yeah, Frankie, can you tell me a little bit of your perspective on that same challenge?
I think that it is something that's needed, and with our programs, to have the services that we have in jail at this time has helped so many individuals and keeping them open-minded and know that there are resources in the community that they can go back in and use. So I think that would help.
Yeah, and so I think in so many ways, let's make sure you understand exactly Sam's story. Probably a case, Brett Dahlberg, where you get back and you go, oh my gosh, I've got so much more great stuff from Sam. She's this really remarkable person. You probably didn't enjoy editing this down, I suspect.
No, there was a lot that we talked about that I would have loved to put in the story. I'll just share a quick tidbit that happened at the end of the first time that I met with Sam. We met at the YWCA building, and we had talked for a good hour at this point, and I asked Sam if I could take a picture of her, and she said no. And this appears at the very end, if you make it to the very end of the story that's on our website. this little anecdote appears, but I asked Sam if I could take her picture, and she said no. And I said, you know, I understand that we don't always like the way that we look. I did my journalism thing where I say, you know, part of the reason that I love this field is that we try to portray things as they are, and sometimes as they are is difficult, and it's not always exactly what we want them to be. And Sam said, no, I get that, but this is not who I am. And I happened to be there in the morning, and Sam was not dressed the way that she usually is. She had her PJs on still. And she said, you know, every time I go outside, I dress up now. And I know that I don't have to. And I know that I might just be going to the grocery store. I might just be going to a meeting, but I dress up. And that's a way for me to, she said, a way for me to remember that I'm at a different point in my life than I was before. And I thought, you know, as just a way, a visual way to remind ourselves that we can be in different places in our lives as we move through them. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, no doubt. Very powerful. So, Sam, before we even, I think Brett has given us a sign point to build toward, but let's go back in your story a little bit. Where are you from originally?
So I was actually born in Rochester. I am adopted, and I ended up living with a great family that I'm very fortunate to have in Brockport, New York, and that's where I was raised and went to school until about 11th grade when I dropped out and got my GED, and that was really the downfall, the start of it all.
Okay, well, and I want to say from the outset of the hour, too, you have been very open in sharing your story with Brett. I appreciate you being here now. And you strike me as a very open and animated person, but I also want to say there's no question that if there's anything that you don't want to talk about, that I understand. So I think just understanding your story, though, is really instructive. That's why I think WXXI News has really benefited from having your voice here. So when you say that your downfall started at, you know, 17 years old, what particularly, though, maybe sparked that?
Grew up in a sheltered home. I came from a bad background. My biological parents were drug addicts. And on top of that, I mean, there was a lot of abuse in the household, and that's why me and my siblings were ended up being taken out of the home. Mm. And my mom, actually, she raised us as best as she could, and I ended up having a very codependent relationship, but also having a very independent personality. So at 17, I was ready to book, got my own apartment, and that's when the partying started. And meanwhile, mommy was paying my bills, and things just spiraled out of control. It started, you know, using recreationally, and then I had a miscarriage when I was 18 years old, and I thought a baby would fix everything. Up until that point, I really had a pretty strong faith, I would say. No, I didn't go to church or follow any specific religion, but I did believe in a higher power. And I had experienced a lot of death up until that point. My father died, my brother died, my grandpa. So a lot of trauma as a child. And when I became an adult and had this miscarriage, I couldn't wrap my head around, you know, why my God would take an innocent life. That's was my perspective. So that's when I started using heroin.
At age 18?
Yeah, no, well, 19.
19.
Yes. Okay. And that was to numb the pain of that loss. Someone in my life who I trusted and loved offered it as a solution, and it was a solution long before it was my problem.
Where would you get it from?
So typically, I mean, at first when it was all fun and games, people would get it for me. But eventually you become connected with a bunch of local drug dealers, and I would make the drive out to Rochester every day. And get what I needed, come back. And typically on, you know, when it got really bad, sometimes I would drive out multiple times a day, you know, have $100 in my pocket, buy $80 worth of drugs, buy a pack of cigarettes, and save the last $5 I had for gas.
Wow. Where was the money coming from at that point? Were you working?
Yes, I did. I was working. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I could never hold a job a few months, if that. I've always been a pretty decent worker. I mean, I've gotten promoted at almost every job I worked at, but eventually the drug use would catch up to me. Mm-hmm. And I would start showing up late or not showing up at all. And, you know, us addicts have endless excuses, not to mention I was probably the most manipulative person I knew at that point and could pretty much talk my way out of anything, which is why I was able to hide my addiction for so long.
Did you, when you're making those drives to Rochester, sometimes multiple times a day, did you want to stop it somehow, or did you accept that that was part of life at that point?
So I got to the point, like in the beginning, like I said, it was fun. I went out with a group. Because when I started 7 years ago, it was a fad. I mean, there were groups of people from my school, and it was the cool thing to do. I mean,
heroin was the cool thing to do.
It was. A lot of people did pills. A lot of people did heroin. I mean, I hung out with a crowd that partied, and it transitioned from party drugs to heroin. And, you know, it became more acceptable, I guess, you know, for me to shoot up at a party. At first, it seemed almost normal because I had a group of friends. But then as, you know, I started to be found out by people who loved me and who really cared about me. That's when I realized that it was not what it was, you know, made up to be. And the first time that really hit hard was when I woke up and was physically ill, going through withdrawal. And I thought I had the flu.
And it was withdrawal, but had you used the day before?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, once
so
your body,
you needed a lot of it.
Oh yeah. Once your body becomes physically addicted, I mean, no, you don't need a lot to come out of withdrawal. But once your body becomes physically addicted, I mean, you're dependent on it, to stay out of that sickness. And, firsthand, I will tell you, there was nothing I was doing when I was going through withdrawal. I was not going to work. Thank God. You know, I wasn't a mother at that time because I can't imagine getting out of bed and taking care of a child. I would lay in bed all day and go between my bed and the shower.
And so when you kind of get to the point of that lowest point that Brett described and you described in Brett's reporting, when you sort of bottomed out, you had overdosed, you had needed some really strong work interventionally to save your life. That was how long ago? When did that happen?
December of 2018. December of 2017. Yes, you're right. I'm a little behind. Yeah, so what ended up happening is just years of just trying. I just tried so many times to be sober and to live a productive life, and nothing. I felt like I was always going to be an addict. I was always going to do dope. I was always going to be a junkie, and that's how I was going to die. And it got to a point where I was so depressed and just so lost. I had no sense of self. I didn't know who I was. And I got to a point where the combination of the addiction and the mental health I struggle with was, you know, telling me that death would be the only way out. And I sought out fentanyl. And as you know, fentanyl is what a lot of the drugs on the street are being cut with nowadays. And that is what is killing everybody. There's no way really to know. I mean, unless you're that cool with your drug dealer to ask him, hey, did you cut this with fentanyl? And that's why everyone is dying. And I sought out the fentanyl. I shot up is the size of my pinky nail, and I was dead for 4 minutes, according to the EMT. And it was that third shot of Narcan that brought me out of it. And I actually even had an out-of-body experience, and let me tell you, it scared the crap out of me.
How much do you remember otherwise? I mean, coming back into consciousness, do you remember anything?
Well, you know, this is the part of my story that I actually, one of my favorite parts about sharing at a meeting, and it's no way funny, but I can look back at it now and laugh. You know, I thought to myself, oh, well, I came into this world naked, might as well go out that way. Literally stripped down, got in the shower, shot up the fentanyl, and I woke up with about 35 people in my living room, completely naked. And the first thing I said was, am I dead? And I was pretty disappointed when he said no. And then comic relief, I was like, well, get me a towel. You haven't even bought me dinner. And he was like, do you understand that you just died? And at that time, I was like, yeah, I understand that you saved me and I didn't ask you to.
Wow.
And, you know, as funny, I can look back and laugh at it now, like, at the time, that was really where my headspace was. I was pissed that I had been brought back to life.
How long did it take for that to change? Because the story talks about, you know, at this point, you end up stealing, you get, mm-hmm. you end up going to jail. How quickly did that sort of happen?
So, long story cut very short,
yeah.
I ended up having, I did seek help. I told my mom that I deliberately was trying to kill myself. I tried to get on a depression medication to help, and was, the intention was to, you know, seek other help at a rehab eventually, but within 2 weeks I was back at it. There was another suicide attempt where I shot up 12 bags of heroin in my feet and woke up on the floor 9 hours later in a trap house. And I called my mom and I said, I can't live and I can't even die. And she said, well, how about trying to live? Actually trying. So I checked myself into Strong, pleaded with them not to release me at week two. And they released me anyways, despite my request, and I was back at it. And that's when, you know, all the criminal activity started. That's when I started stealing. I was driving a car around that was uninsured. I mean, just belligerent stuff, just acting insane. And I ended up being arrested out of a psych ward for the second time. At that point, I was just like, whatever.
When you were telling Strong, don't release me, did they say, we have to release you? We don't have sort of justification to keep you? Was it an insurance thing? What was the...
They said they had done everything they could for me. But
you're telling them, I'm spiraling. If I leave this, I'm going into a bad place.
I did ask them. And, you know, nothing against Strong. I do believe that they think they did as much as they could. But, I mean, when you have the severe depression that I was suffering from on top of, you know, a long list of mental illness, I mean, 2 weeks is not enough to feel any kind of difference. Being locked up at downtown for the first 2 months, on top of the 4 months, you know, down the line. When I say jail saved my life, both times did, because I started a medicine there and it took 2 months for me to feel any kind of difference, to have any will to live.
And what about withdrawal symptoms, things like that? I mean, and forgive me, I'm assuming at this point you're not using heroin when you're locked up.
Right. I mean, yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
So, I did experience withdrawal. There's a place in jail, it's called REC, where they bring all the withdrawalees. That was pretty epic. It was awful. 23-1, locked up for 23 hours and out for an hour, basically dying on the floor of a cell. That is something I never want to experience again. Not to mention the fellow humans around you also dying,
mm-hmm.
or that's what it feels like.
And so after 2 months, what, you know, was it sort of medically your body starts to change? Did you have a change of heart in some way? I mean, what was it like feeling different?
I mean, it's a combination of a lot. I mean, the first week I was there, I was just so helpless and so hopeless. I hit my knees and was like, yo, this is the exact prayer I said. I'm not over-exaggerating. I said, yo, if you exist, help me, because I am stuck and I don't know what to do. And my mind is telling me the only thing that will work is death. And something, I choose to believe that it was my higher power, made me get out of bed and take that antidepressant every day. And, you know, try to take advantage of the time I had while I was downtown for those first 2 months. Reading, writing poetry, you know, trying to find a sense of self, which is difficult when you're on your own, which is why these two women, my next stay in jail when I took my sentence, you know, changed my world.
When did you first encounter that? And as best you can, Sam, give me a sense for maybe the first day where you felt like, you know what, dying doesn't seem like a great option. Like maybe something is turning here.
I'm going to be honest with you. There is not a specific day I can tell you where I bounced up and was like, yeah, I'm ready to live. It was an ongoing struggle. I mean, every day was hard. I still sometimes wake up and I'm like, is this worth it? And that is the honest to God's truth. Most of the time when I am feeling that and I choose to reach out through the programs I'm involved in, the recovery efforts, where I live, eventually, by the end of that day, typically my answer will be, yes, this is worth it, 100%. But there are days when I wake up and it feels like it's not. And that is the truth. And I mean, I would assume most addicts would tell you that. It is hard. Nothing about recovery is easy. Every day is a battle. And, you know, one day sober, if you're listening and you have one day clean, you're doing something. And, you know, that's the message we try to send recovering addicts or people who have the desire to get clean, because it isn't easy. And it is a battle, but it is worth it.
I can tell you, it's not, and I know you know this, it's not just addicts who, you know, have to ask those questions. I mean, people who struggle with depression, people who struggle with mental health will ask those questions. And it's really hard for people around them who love them, who don't necessarily understand. So if there's someone who is addicted to heroin in your family and you don't or if there's someone who is struggling with depression, the people around you who don't understand might look at you and say, well, Sam, just stop using, or, you know, look, you've got so much going. What do you want people to hear that will make it at least a little more constructive or helpful, because they love you and there's a lot of people in your position and they want to help you? But so often what we often say doesn't really work. In fact, maybe it makes it worse at times. Is anything sinking a little? You're shaking your head.
Yeah, honestly, if that worked, I would have been sober within the first year.
Yeah.
I mean, my mom, oh God, that poor woman, gosh, I've put her through so much, and there was not one moment that she gave up. When she pressed charges on me, and yes, she is the one who put me in jail, she did it to save my life. There was no point in time when she wanted me to suffer, or, you know, wanted me to be homeless, wanted me to live in trap houses, wanted me to wake up going through withdrawal. And if words could save an addict, there would be no addicts, because there is someone out there who loves every addict walking the streets in rehabs. It is a battle that we fight from the inside. It is a battle with ourselves. And, you know, the love and the support, it does make a difference. I'm not going to sit here and say it doesn't. You know, you should always support the people you love and stand in their corner. And there's a fine line between support and enabling, and I do want to make that abundantly clear. My poor mother, I love you, but she is guilty of enabling me at times. And regardless of that, though, I would have found a way. It's not until I wanted to get sober that I got sober. And that's the truth, you know? It did help to be stuck, in my thoughts. And, you know, that's where this programming comes in at jail. I mean, a lot of, Brett, you said you think, when you think jail, you think of it as a hopeless place. It is, but that is not a bad thing. You are at a whole other bottom when you're at jail. And, you know, especially when you've burned all your bridges and have no one putting money on your commissary. That is some real life stuff right there. I mean, you don't even have shampoo. And I'm not even, you know, I'm not over exaggerating. Like, that is something we take for granted when we're on the outside. But when you get in jail and you realize, wow, I have no one. I have no one. And do I even have myself? I had no idea who I was, what I wanted to do, if I even wanted to do anything. You know, sometimes I thought, well, maybe I'll just stay here. This seems easy. I don't know if I can do life. And when I walked out those doors, I was terrified, but at least because of this programming, I knew I had a place to go, I had a plan, I had support, and I knew what I needed to do, and I also was starting to develop a strong sense of self.
This is an amazing story, and I'm looking at the clock going, but there's so much more we have to talk about. So in our second half hour, we're really going to dive into the program, the support services, and that Sam has just started talking about. One other point, though, because this is a whole separate conversation, and it is one of the single hardest conversations probably family or loved ones have. But can you, as best as you can, describe for me the fine line where you see the difference of love start to become enabling?
Whoa, that's a tricky one.
I know it is, and it's so hard.
So, you know, I think that's... I mean, that varies from family to family, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I do know for myself, I mean, that could, oh, geez. It's really kind of a sense of, you just are in denial. I mean, it's pure denial. You look at your loved one and you see what you want to see. You're blinded by love, and that's the best way I can put it. You are literally, I mean, you love this person so much, you want to think, you want to believe that they are telling you that the truth, that when they say they want to get clean, that they mean it. When they ask you for a ride to the hood for, I don't know, to pick up a bus pass, that they mean it, that's actually what they're going to do. You know, and today, I mean, my mom, she has no reason to trust me. She has no reason after everything I've done to her, but she is working with me and she is working with my recovery, you know, and but at the same time, if something happened tomorrow and my life fell back into the gutter and I got kicked out of the Y, you know, lost custody again of my child, she would not, at this point, after everything, I think she knows not to do anything. I mean, sometimes you just have to sit back and let us prove it and let us show you that we're making a difference and let us do it on our own. Because just like the programming in jail, it is very much a do you want to? It's on a I want terms. They don't make you go. You don't have to wake up for morning meditation with Frankie. You don't have to sign up for programming. And when I was on the sentence side, I didn't have to sign up to be in Pink's, which is the recovery program. It is a want. Okay, just like on the outside, if you want to get clean, you can reach out. There are not only other addicts that will help you, but there's a place called Open Access on University. You can walk in there and say, this is what I think I need. Can you please help me? Whether that's detox, inpatient, outpatient, they will help you and they will connect you with somewhere.
You're an amazing woman. This is a remarkable story, and it's all because Brett Dahlberg, WXXI, brought this to us just recently. Brett's here. He's a WXXI health reporter and producer. Yeah, I even more so now, I feel like I would not have wanted to be in your shoes having to tell and edit this story because they're so powerful. There's so much there.
It's hard, yeah. And, you know, Sam has a heck of a story, right? But she's also in many ways not an outlier. And I think that's important to remember, too, that, you know, addiction hits a lot of people. Recovery is available for a lot of people. But so many of the things that Sam described also I've heard, you know, piecemeal, maybe not all in one story, but I've heard those from other people. The difficulty of distinguishing love from enabling, the ease that you develop with manipulation, the tie to the drug. I mean, all of those things are replaying across a lot of people in our communities. And Sam is here, you know, putting all of those things into one story, which is pretty remarkable, but those issues are not unique to one person.
That's true. And telling the story is definitely going to help people. There's no question about it. Let's get our only break of the hour. When we come back, Tisha Smith, Frankie Sampson are going to help us understand exactly some of what those programs were that helped Sam kind of see her own future and what they're doing now to help others in Sam's position. So let's go ahead and take that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, if you are a person of faith, what do you think your faith calls you to do when it comes to the environment, when it comes to climate change, when it comes to preservation of the conditions on this planet for future generations? Asbury First United Methodist Church is hosting an event this coming weekend called God's Own Junkyard, Environmental Stewardship in New York State. We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tisha Smith is Director of Inmate and Drug and Alcohol Treatment Programs in the Jail Bureau at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. And I think Brett Dahlberg's point's an important one, so I'll ask you to kind of elaborate on this point. Sam's story is, no doubt, it's gripping. And it's partially gripping because she's so blunt and clear about telling it, which is a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. But there are so many people in this position, aren't there? It's probably important to keep this in mind, isn't it?
We have a unit full of people that are blunt and just as important, I will say, just as deep as Sam's story is. We have whole units full of people with similar stories, if not worse. And, you know, I started to tear up as she talked because this is exactly what the type of impact that I wanted to have when I got this job about 2 years ago. When I was there previous in another entity a few years ago, and much like then, one of the things that we didn't offer inmates that were unsentenced was really any support or help at all. They would just come in unsentenced, go through the court system, and then be discharged and leave. And when I came on board, I just kind of, there was something tugging at me that, you know, I just always felt that it was the most anxious population that we have are our unsentenced folks, because they don't know what's going to happen. They have court cases, they have families, they have loved ones, they work, they have school in some cases. They just have a lot going on, and they don't know what's going to happen to whatever they've got that's going on. On top of that, they're dealing with mental health issues or chemical dependency issues. And so I set upon this path of getting help for our unsentenced folks out at the correctional facility, and was given permission to initially hire two counselors. And that's when I brought Frankie Sampson and Kelly Robinson on. And Kelly works with our sentence ladies, and Miss Frankie here serves our unsentenced population. And you could see the change in the building, where the anxiety level dramatically decreased, because now you have a liaison between the jail and the court. So they could call court and say, hey, what's going on with so-and-so's court case? Or if somebody's waiting on a bed at a halfway house or one of our treatment facilities, we could find out where they are on the list. And then we can let them know, hey, you're number 13 on the list. Hold tight. It'll be about a week or two. And then that would like tone everything down. And so I think it was extremely important when I first came on to at least provide some kind of services to folks who traditionally didn't get those services. Like you said, there are many, many, many people that are struggling with their addiction and their mental health issues while they're incarcerated. And we're trying as best we can by also increasing our staff to provide services to those folks as well, so that when they leave, we can at least attempt as a community to kind of mitigate some of those circumstances that led them to get to jail in the first place.
In terms of the need, there's a point in Brett's piece where you're looking at the schedule, the calendar, right?
Yeah.
And it's crammed.
Yes. I had Dr. Smith lay out her calendars for me. There's four of them. It doesn't all fit onto one calendar. She needs four to keep track of all of the programs that are going on.
I now have six.
You have six now.
And your report's, what, several weeks old now?
Right,
a month old?
Maybe a month old. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's growing. I mean, and that's part of why this program, this work stuck out to me, is that it's not only new, but it's still developing. And it's also part of a larger trend, not just in this community, but across the country, of correctional systems looking to engage people in counseling and in activities while they're in jail or prison. Mm-hmm. And you know, here's a little microcosm that we see in the calendars of that bearing out on a local level, where there are so many programs that are under development now and that are getting added to the calendars, you know, even since we did this story just a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. that Dr. Smith can't keep them all in one place. It's got to be these big fold-out calendars that spread across the desk.
And initially, I thought that was like a really embarrassing shot, because I was like, you got to see like my crazy desk and how messed up everything is. But I think after I saw it, I was like, at least people can get to see that it's not just as easy as having a counselor in the jail. It's about coordinating volunteers. It's about coordinating services that are coming into paid services and some of our contractual services that are coming into the jail to provide treatment and vocational programming and therapy. And so when you were there, it was really before we started our medication-assisted treatment program. So that's why I have new calendars. So in addition to all of that stuff, and I'd also like to say that drug and alcohol treatment is not new to the correctional facility. I mean, it's been there for over 20 years. And there was another person running the program for all that time. Mm-hmm. And then I came on board, like I said, 2 years ago, and things kind of changed over time. And so I wanted to kind of bring back the robustness, if you will, of the program. And so I've been able to do that in spades, and also hire new additional staff and also expand the program out. And we're growing even more.
Now, there's probably a whole separate conversation on medically assisted treatment.
Yes.
And which has been controversial.
Yes.
It's also, from what I have read, and I want to be careful here because I'm going back in my own memory here, in terms of what is effective, it can be effective, but I understand why it's controversial. Is this something that you're looking more on into here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in a look at the medical literature in my reporting, I've found more than a few cases where people call it, quote, the gold standard, end quote, of
medically assisted treatment.
Medication assisted treatment of addiction treatment. But there are also still concerns that we don't know entirely how well it works. And it's, you know, it's controversial also because people view it as allowing people to continue using addictive substances.
The critics say it's trading an addiction for another addiction.
Sure, right. And supporters say, yeah, but it works in a world where we're trying to reduce the harm done by addictive substances. You know, if you allow somebody to continue, or almost if you encourage somebody to continue using substances that we know sometimes carry a death sentence, that is doing harm.
It is not without controversy, but it's a separate conversation going forward. And Sam across the table was gesturing. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I have a pretty strong opinion on that, so I'm not going to get into it completely. But I will say this. I'm assuming you're talking about maintenance.
Suboxone, buprenorphine. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, I have nothing but good things to say about Vivitrol. I know people, and it has changed their world. But with that being said, as far as other maintenance programs, I do not agree with them. I am not going to say I have not taken some of those medications to get me through withdrawal. But as far as continuing to take them, your body does become physically addicted to them. Mm. And I know because I have experienced that. And the withdrawal is 10 times worse than coming off of heroin. And oftentimes it does lead right back to heroin use. If it works for you, it works. I'm not going to bash anyone who takes it, and I'm definitely not. I will extend my hand to help anyone, whether maintenance program or not.
You're just sharing your story.
But yeah, that is my experience, and not only mine, but many people I know in the program and who have also, you know, been heroin addicts for years.
All right, so that merits its whole other reporting and discussion.
Sure,
but
people in the field will point out that it's medication-assisted treatment.
Right.
And part of what it's assisting is, and what it goes with when it seems to be most effective, is some of the counseling and therapy that Frankie and Dr. Smith, you know, do on a daily basis.
Well, let's talk about what they're doing on a daily basis. And Frank, I want you to flesh out for me what a day might look like. And based on the fact that the calendar is so full, I mean, I'm sure it is a lot of work and a lot of coordination. What is it like? Take me through that.
Most of my mornings, I'm in the units talking to the ladies, and we do morning meditation. We go through morning meditation books, and we discuss the topic, and then we have an open dialogue. Then our next groups will do, we have yoga, we have journaling, we have poetry. We have, what else do we have?
We have outside providers come in, like U of R.
The school.
So, like, talk about, like, a Friday. It's like Friday is, like, chaos now.
Friday has everyone there. So we have open access. We have WISH. We have VOA. We have Urban League that come in all in the morning, step by step. So ladies have a lot of opportunity to go to a program on top of morning meditation where we do groups. So I allow them to pick what they want to go to. And if we do one-on-ones where I will sit down and do individual counseling so that we'll talk about that particular person's issues, what they want to work on, their goals, their discharge planning. So what's going to happen when I leave here? And we try to make sure they're connected with all the community resources that are available to them so that they know where they can go. Open Access does their group, and we kind of work together. So if they're having trouble in certain areas, they will work with us to make sure they're connected, even to the point that they will come pick them up in the morning of their release so that they're getting to where they need to be. But there's a lot of opportunities with the education. We have the dog program for the men that we have going on. We had it for the ladies for a little bit.
A dog program?
Yes. So we have a partnership with Lollipop Farm where our inmates are training unadoptable, or up until that point, dogs, and teaching them how to, you know, just do basic things like sit, roll over, shake a hand, that kind of thing, to make them a little bit more appealing to people that are going to adopt dogs. So we have that program. We also have a therapy dog program where a therapy dog actually just comes in and just like hangs with the ladies. The dog doesn't, I mean, there's nothing. They just talk about life, and the dog just hangs out with them, and it kind of just... It's therapeutic.
Yeah, it is therapeutic. Animals are therapeutic. In fact, Sam across the table is kind of giving me a thumbs up there. So what was working for you, Sam, when you were there for what, 4+ months?
It was actually exactly 180 days that I was working with these two women in particular. I'm sorry. No, that's incorrect. I was with them for about 2 months.
Okay.
Obviously, Tisha is the big boss lady, so I didn't see her as much, but Frankie for about 2 months, and then Kelly for another two. But when I was working with Frankie, I mean, I'm pretty sure that on most days I was at everything I could possibly be at. Mm-hmm. And if I couldn't go because, you know, God forbid, I have to shower, when I can, or get to, the nurse when they call me. And let me tell you, it ruined my day when I missed it. But then on the other side, when I was sentenced, I was in the PINK program, and I don't know if Tisha wants to tell you a little more about that. But it was more in depth. Mm-hmm.
So our PINK program, so they call it the PINKs, or I'm in PINK, or, you know, it's just referred to as a PINKs program, even though that's not the formal title. They have PINK uniforms to distinguish themselves from the other inmates. These are program people. These are people that are involved in the drug and alcohol program. And so they don't wear the same color. So it's just a matter of distinction. And it just happens to be pink. So we call them the Pinks. And so when you walk in to the unit, you could say Pinks, and like everybody in pink will come over to you. And it's just a matter of distinction. And I will just say that, you know, we have, there's so many, our community has responded very well to our pleas for assistance with our inmates. And I'll just say that, you know, even just working in the jail is something that I think some of our community-based organizations kind of want to do. So they'll apply for a grant to work with our folks and end up coming into the jail. So we just recently started a pretty intense cognitive behavioral intervention type of group with the Volunteers of America. And we've started with both our male population, our female population, and our veterans unit. So we're just starting that out. And so it's involves intensive journaling and a different form of therapy that gets people to kind of look at their thinking processes and their impulsivity and their behavior and then puts it into practice so that people can kind of like role play how they will handle certain situations after they get out. And so I think it's pretty intense. I've heard the feedback so far is like, this was like really deep. And so it's not like a typical kind of what you might think of as like a fluffy kind of group. I'm not about fluff, so I don't really have like fluffy, let's pass our time kind of like, you know, we're going to make it look like we're doing something kind of groups. I wanted people to actually like think and actually, you know, really try and solve some of their problems so that when they leave, they're not, you know, interacting with the same people and doing the same kinds of behavior.
I mean, Brad, you're reporting, she said she felt like she had a toolkit, right?
Yeah, definitely. But before that, I mean, Sam talked to me about how hard it was to dig deep. You know, she's here telling us these things like we've talked about bluntly and honestly, but that is not always, we talked about, the way that it was. And it took a lot of really difficult work to dig deep into personality and into personal experience and history to be able to talk about it like we are right now.
Well, Sam, in the last few minutes here, tell me about the tools that you feel like you have left with that have already helped you.
So what it really boils down to is coping skills. I mean, as a child, I grew up in a home where that did not exist. If you had a problem, you swept it under the rug, slapped a smile on your face, and went through the day. And that's what I did. You know, I remember when my brother killed himself. That is a traumatic thing to experience at 10 years old. I went to school 2 days after that. You know, and that's just an idea of, you know, how I managed to cope. I ignored things. I pretended they were not there. And that lasted up and through my teenage years and early adulthood. And finally, you get to a point, I mean, obviously, like I had said earlier, drugs are my solution long before they were my problem. That was the only coping mechanism I had, the only coping skill I had, the only thing I knew to do to deal with my problems. And, you know, I'm looking around me, watching other people who have gone through the same things who aren't doing heroin to, you know, get through life. But, you know, I think some of us, unfortunately, some of us have that addict mind. You know, I do believe that it's a disease, and I crossed a line, and that was it for me. But as far as coping skills, you know, the biggest thing was really developing a sense of self. Like I had mentioned earlier, I had no idea who I was. I mean, in my mind, the only thing I could really identify was I'm a junkie. That's it. That's all I was. In my mind, that's all I was. Oh, and when I did meet these two ladies, I was a mom, barely. You know, and unfortunately, that was my reality. I was barely a mother. So these women told, you know, really help you get to know who you are and lay out, you know, who you want to be. Who do you want to be in this world? You know, what do you want to do? And really learning how to love yourself is like the biggest part of it, because I will tell you, when the women, especially drug addicted women, when we land ourselves in that jail, we are broken, we are battered, we are lost. And to be able to leave and actually feel like I have an identity and like I'm something more than a junkie on the streets and that I can do something else is huge. I can't really list out a set of skills. I mean, there's so many different coping skills I've learned that I still practice to this day. I mean, things as simple as counting to 10 before I respond to somebody who's giving me a hard time. Deep breathing, meditating. I mean, meditating is a huge thing. And I actually also, in jail, one of my go-to coping skills was writing poetry. And I actually got so into it. I wrote a whole book in jail that I'm actually typing a manuscript for right now. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I never would have thought that's something I could do.
This has been, I mean, like, we could have done this all day, Brett.
Yep. So I do think, right before we finish, it's worth pointing out that this is a small look at a bigger issue of correctional systems moving away from punitive forms of work and toward rehabilitation. And part of that is because of the opioid epidemic, because people see it as a death sentence if you don't help people prepare for what it's going to be like for them when they get out.
But even apart from opioids, it's also about what works.
Sure.
And what will help. And I want to say to Tisha Smith, I hope we can continue these conversations. Thank you so much for Frankie, the work you're doing, amazing. And Brett Dahlberg, great reporting on this. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Sam, I hope we can continue talking to you. You're an inspiring, amazing person.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You got it. More connections coming up.